Chapter 11. Being assertive and delegating. These are important skills to have when you're a leader. How else can you really lead? Yet, many new leaders struggle to be assertive with their team members and struggle to delegate out work. Why is this so? In my opinion, there are two primary factors and they are called drivers. A driver is a script or theme that you have learnt early in life because it worked for you as a child and you continue to use those scripts or programs as you grow up. In other words, it continues to drive you. However, ironically, as an adult, they actually can sabotage you. As a leader, they sink you. So what are those primary drivers? The driver to please others. Somehow, some of us learn very early in life that in order to get along, to get rewards, and to survive in the world, the best thing to do was to please other people, especially people who were significant in our life, like parents, grandparents, and later, teachers and others. Get them to like us was our motto. Keep others happy by giving in to their needs, their wants, and their desires. Then they'll like us, and we'll all be okay, and life will be good. Now, we didn't consciously make this decision, but at a subconscious level, we worked out that that's how we needed to survive as a child in order to get by. Further, the driver served us well in adolescence, where we made sure, consciously and subconsciously, to get on with others, including our teachers. We didn't muck up. We got our work done, and we generally towed the line. People seemed to like us as a result. Take this to the extreme, however, and you end up pleasing others so much that you never, or really, end up pleasing yourself. In a sense, people whittle themselves away. When people do this, they not only feel down and depressed, but they feel inadequate because they have successfully sabotaged themselves. They don't know who they really are because they've never allowed themselves the chance to consider themselves or be their own person. What if they don't like me? That would be terrible. They are lost to themselves. They don't know their strengths or talents and what makes them tick. They haven't discovered what makes them unique, what makes them them. There's a Chinese proverb which says, "We'd be less concerned with what others thought of us if we knew how seldom they actually do." Certainly, it is fitting and appropriate to please others and to help them, but to do so all or most of the time to the continual detriment of yourself is not wise. Continually pleasing others frequently means that you end up having nothing left for yourself, no time, no energy, nothing. Starting to stand up for yourself and therefore having people say no to you might be the unthinkable. Oh, how awful, how embarrassing. If someone says no to you, you take it personally. We don't like people to reject us in any way. Imagine then how this might impact you as a new leader. You find it difficult to tell others what to do, to confront others if necessary, to set targets, to set deadlines, and to be assertive. You may not delegate out work because that might somehow impose on others and they may not like you. Failure to delegate means that you end up with the work piling up on your own plate and in the end, you feel swamped with so much work. Of course, this workload means that you have no time either to attend to your team. You're drowning in work. You also tend not to speak up if you see some issue occurring, like a staff member not performing, or perhaps two team members not getting on well together. You struggle with controlling your team, and often new leaders just hope that the issue will go away. They don't, and in fact they get worse. The team tends to become discouraged because there is little, if any, direction, and perhaps one or two more rebellious team members might push limits. For example, they might turn up late for meetings or don't produce work on time. Or else one or two members engage in gossip and innuendo, and before too long, the team is toxic. If the new leader struggled before, now at this point, they are literally drowning. all because they were too afraid to speak up and intervene. I often say in my workshops, why try to please everyone? The reality is that around 3 out of every 10 people are not going to like you anyway. Because of your need to please, you may well get pulled into all sorts of meetings, projects and activities, including the social club at work. You can't really say no, which means that you're stretched in all sorts of ways and often end up running from meeting to meeting. At the end of the day, you're exhausted and wonder what you really did in your day. Of course, this might also mean that you need to stay back to try to get on top of your workload. Life ends up going to work, eating, and going to sleep before the cycle repeats itself next day. When Sammy Davis Jr. was on tour in Australia, he was asked, "What is the secret to success?" He replied, "I don't know, but what I do know is the secret to failure. It's trying to please everyone else." Not surprisingly, the new leader experiences anxiety, which moves into feelings of being depressed. Physically, they start to experience fatigue and tiredness, and perhaps become ill or sick because of the stress of it all. The overall message is, what got you here won't get you there. In other words, your need to please others might have worked as a child and into young adulthood, but it now no longer serves you and will in fact sabotage you if you wish to stay in the leadership role. You need to decide that if you want to grow personally and grow professionally into leadership, then you have to change this pattern at both the conscious and subconscious level. You have to move into the courage zone and be prepared to do it differently. I've written much more about this topic in the book called Stopping Your Self-Sabotage: Steps to Increasing Your Self-Confidence, which is available in either hard copy, Kindle, or audio. Just go to howtostopselfsabotage.com. The driver to be perfect. Again, this driver originates from very early days when, as a child, you learnt that in order to get any praise, you had to do things well, very well. It wasn't good enough to do a good job, it had to be perfect. This carried over to school, where you had to achieve well and get top marks, or close to it. It might have been on the sports field, where you had to be in the best players each week, or be in the top goal scorers. It might have been in the gym class, where you had to win at competitions or get in the medals. Nevertheless, the message was clear. To get on and to get recognition, you had to do it perfectly. As before, this theme continued on through school and into trade school or university, and then into your first job. The way to handle life is to try to be perfect in what you do. It got you rewards. You might have gotten awards at school or for your studies, and at work your bosses would have loved you because you did the job exceptionally well. If you did a really, really good job, you'll be accepted and others will like you. As a perfectionist, you would hate to make a mistake or have someone criticize you. How dreadful, how awful, how humiliating. Although they strive relentlessly for perfection, these people always feel inferior because they never quite reach the perfection they want. It's never good enough. This is, in fact, a dead end. Certainly, too, it's rarely good enough for those around them who frequently find fault, which just compounds the situation. It's a no-win situation in which they have successfully sabotaged themselves. They try not to make mistakes and try hard to get things right all the time. They lack the spontaneity and freedom to experiment and be themselves. They experience real stress. They are under constant duress. The message instead is that life is about making mistakes and learning from them. This is how people grow and develop. It might seem strange, but those who have been the most successful in life are those who have made the most mistakes and learnt from them. Someone once said, "The only failure in life is the failure to participate. Are you prepared to get it close enough and do a conscientious job without doing it perfectly? Have you ever noticed that what you think is perfect may not be what the next person considers perfect? Being perfect, therefore, is a no-win. Imagine then how this might impact you as a new leader. While before you had control over your work and you did a really good job at it, often because you stayed behind after work or came in on weekends to catch up, your team members probably don't have the same standards as you do. As a perfectionist, you are able to control your own work, but now with people in your team, there are so many other factors at play which makes control extremely difficult. How do you manage this? Typically, you might decide to do all the work yourself, or at least check all the work before it goes out, which means you become inundated. You might get behind as a result, and of course, none of this is perfect, and it sends you into a depressed spiral. You probably don't want to come to work or have sick days off, because you might genuinely be sick or just want some reprieve somehow. As someone once wrote, "It is not who you are that holds you back. It is who you think you are not." Now, imagine if you had both drivers, pleasing others and being perfect, inherent in your upbringing. It's really not hard to imagine the stress that builds up very quickly for a new leader. They get out of their depth very quickly. They feel overwhelmed and isolated. It must be them that is at fault. Obviously, they're not good enough. Maybe they weren't cut out for this management stuff anyway. Their confidence plummets. They feel trapped. Stress in the form of anxiety or depression becomes obvious, and ultimately, if the new leader doesn't make some changes, they end up either burning out, which is tragic to see, where the repercussions are serious in terms of their personality and future career prospects, or they end up stepping back from leadership and staying in their former role with no responsibility for others. I have seen both occur. At least in the latter circumstance, there is no damage to their psyche. As I've said before, what got you here won't get you there. Again, for a more in-depth analysis, I'd refer you to my other book, How to Stop Your Self-Sabotage. Being assertive. Assuming that you have taken steps on reworking those sabotaging drivers, let's focus now on the skill of assertion itself. Beliefs. In order to be assertive, it is important to accept two basic beliefs about standing up for yourself. These include, number one, that assertion, rather than manipulation, submission, or hostility, enriches life and ultimately leads to more satisfying personal relationships with people. And secondly, that everyone is entitled to act assertively and to express honest thoughts, feelings, and beliefs. Steps of behavior. So what happens if you decide to be appropriately assertive? If you're feeling stretched, tense and under pressure, how can you respond next time you receive a request to do something? How can you appropriately confront a team member about a specific issue? What do you say if there is yet another request to attend a meeting, which is really for information only, and one that only keeps you in the loop? Note the following pointers. You don't have to respond with an answer immediately. Don't be caught off guard. Give yourself time. Say something like, "It's nice of you to ask me, but I'd like to think about it for a day or perhaps a week." In the ensuing day or week, you can usually sort out your priorities and decide if you really want to be involved. When responding to a request and you need to say no, be definite and say something like, "Thank you for thinking of me, but I don't wish to be involved at this stage." And if the other person persists, simply repeat what you've said already. Don't be conned into giving endless excuses and reasons and having to justify yourself. There are other times, though, when being assertive is necessary and you need to stand up for yourself. For example, what about when someone pushes in front of you in the queue, or a workmate uses your desk and leaves it in a mess, or a team member is repeatedly late with deadlines? A useful formula or guide for helping you to assertively express difficult negative feelings is to use the following phrases. When, for example, objectively describe the other's behavior. The effects are, describe how the other person's behavior concretely affects your life or feelings. I feel, describe your feelings. And I'd prefer, describe what you want instead. For example, when you use my desk, you leave it in a mess and it's difficult for me to get down to work again and I feel annoyed about that, so I'd prefer if you either didn't use it or cleaned it up once you'd used it. When you continually miss deadlines, then you not only let yourself down and others in the team, but it means that the unit as a whole looks bad, and it puts me under stress too. So I'd really like you to meet the deadlines from this point forward. If you can risk being assertive, you'll be your own best friend. You will learn to really like yourself, and you won't feel resentful towards others or want to hide every time a friend, work colleague, or team member makes a request of you. You'll also feel free to accept invitations to be involved in those areas where you really wish to help out and consider that you have something to offer. Delegating effectively. Delegation is the work of a leader if you really want to get things done. For many managers, though, the hardest part of delegating is trusting that a task will be done well. But it becomes easier when you think of it as a chance to train your staff, not just get rid of some work. The next time you need to delegate something, start by determining who on your team is ready to handle more responsibility. Then create simple tasks to help them learn the skills they'll need. If you'd like someone to take over running a weekly meeting, for instance, have them practice each part of the process. 1 week, they can create an agenda which you'll review. The next, they can watch you run the meeting with plenty of chances to ask questions. Eventually, they'll be ready to run the meeting itself, after which you can offer feedback. This kind of teaching can be time-consuming, but it will go a long way toward preparing your team for more complex work. So, keep in mind that delegation is really about teaching or training others. Beliefs. In order to delegate, it is important to hold certain beliefs about delegation, such as: first, understand the importance of delegating to others as a way to offload work and get more done in your busy life. And secondly, understand that delegation is important in helping others grow and develop, and that it serves to increase self-confidence in others. Levels of delegation. There are actually 6 main ways to delegate, and you may use any one of these at particular times. Number 1, do as I say. Here the instruction is more of a directive and is probably for the junior team member who lacks specific skills and who may be somewhat hesitant or not motivated. Number 2, look into this. This is an exploratory request where you may want certain information, or you may be testing the team member to ascertain their level of skill and ability or their general commitment. Number 3, give me your advice and then I'll decide. Here you are giving some responsibility to do the research or project and you're seeking an opinion. But you're also letting the team member know that you'll make the final decision because you may want to test their decision-making ability, or, in fact, you may need to make the decision yourself because of the magnitude or repercussions of the decision. Number 4. Explore, decide, and check back with me. This is where you are prepared to give more responsibility to the team member, but want to oversee the final decision being made. Number 5, explore and decide within these limits. Here the accountability is clear and the team member knows the parameters, e.g. financial constraints, in which they can move. Number 6. Take care of it for me. Ultimate responsibility and accountability is handed over to the team member. Andrew Carnegie once said, "The secret of success is not in doing your own work, but in recognizing the right person to do it." Steps of behavior. There are a number of steps to be undertaken so that you can effectively delegate. Number 1. Introduce the task. Work out what needs to be delegated. What is the task? Number 2. Choose the right person. Work out their strengths and weaknesses, their interests, and what their current workload looks like. Can they handle the task, and can it be done in the time frame given their present workload? Would this task or project help develop them as an individual? Number 3. Communicate clearly what you want done. State what you're looking for at the end. Specify what you want it to look like when it's completed and done well. Specify the time frame that is required. Number 4. Ensure understanding. Get them to repeat back to you what you believe that you have said. Ask them if they need clarification on anything. Get their commitment to the task and the time frame. 5. Collaboratively work out the methods for follow-up. Set up a reporting and communication system so that you know how things are progressing. This is a critical step in that so many leaders delegate and just expect it to happen. You need to track the progress of what is occurring and be available to offer assistance if necessary. This skill, like so many others, gets easier the more times that you do it. The keys, though, are clear communication and deliberate follow-up. I have seen so many leaders come undone because they took it all for granted that the project was being done, or they assumed that the staff member had it under control, only to find out at the very last minute that it was well behind schedule or that there were holes in it somehow. If this occurs, you look poor as a leader, not only to your team, but to other units or departments, and to your boss, who may be relying on the task being done. John C. Maxwell is quoted as saying, "If you want to do a few small things right, do them yourself. If you want to do great things and make an impact, learn to delegate." Chapter 11, Summary. Being assertive and delegating. The driver to please others. Somehow, some of us learn very early on in life that in order to get along, to get rewards, and to survive in the world, the best thing to do was to please other people, especially people who were significant in our life, like parents, grandparents, and later teachers and others. Take this to the extreme, however, and you end up pleasing others so much that you never or rarely end up pleasing yourself. The driver to be perfect. Again, this driver originates from very early days, when as a child you had learnt that in order to get any praise, you had to do things well, very well. It wasn't good enough to do a good job, it had to be perfect. As a perfectionist, you would hate to make a mistake or have someone criticize you. How dreadful, how awful, how humiliating. Now imagine if you had both drivers, pleasing others and being perfect, inherent in your upbringing. It's really not hard to imagine the stress that builds up very quickly for a new leader. They get out of their depth very quickly because they fail to delegate effectively. What if they get upset with my delegating some stuff to them? And what if they don't do it perfectly like I would? And they resist being assertive and saying it straight. What if they get annoyed with me and don't like me? being assertive. The skill of being assertive relies on two fundamental beliefs that are necessary. Plus, there is a verbal script to follow, which gives a recipe for being assertive. Delegating effectively. Again, there are certain beliefs that you need to hold in order to be effective at delegation. And then there are the procedural steps to follow to ensure that delegation occurs and that, importantly, follow-up actually happens.